A judge will begin hearing the Fairbanks 4 case on Monday.
He's actually been asked to decide whether or not that it's justified to issue declarations of actual innocence.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage's mayor presents his trimmed-down budget plan to the Assembly.
A lot of this was just wringing nickels and dimes out of particular departments and finding more efficient ways of getting things done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The U.S. Supreme Court will decide whether the National Park Service has authority to enforce federal regulations on state-owned lands and rivers in national parks in Alaska. The justices agreed yesterday to hear an appeal from an Alaska hunter who says the Park Service cannot ban him from operating a hovercraft along the Nation River, which runs through the Yukon-Charlie River's National Preserve. John Sturgeon claims all navigable waters, rivers within national parks in Alaska, are state-owned lands and not subject to federal enforcement. But a federal judge ruled that the regulations extend to all parts of the National Park Service. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals also sided with the Park Service. An evidentiary hearing is scheduled to begin Monday in state court in Fairbanks in the case of four Fairbanks men seeking exoneration from convictions for a nearly two-decade-old murder. George Freese, Martin Roberts, Eugene Vent, and Kevin Pease, men known as the Fairbanks Four, were convicted of the October 1997 beating death of 15-year-old John Hartman on a downtown street. But evidence brought forward in recent years points to others being responsible for the killing, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The hearing before Judge Paul Lyle comes at the request of the Alaska Innocence Project, which has been working the case for several years. The Innocence Project attorney would not discuss the upcoming hearing, but longtime case follower, University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism professor Brian O'Donohue, likens it to a non-jury trial in which Judge Lyle will determine what evidence is admissible and then hear it in the courtroom.
And then he will be the one who decides whether or not the Fairbanks Four are entitled not just to a new trial, but he's actually been asked to decide whether or not that it's justified to issue declarations of actual innocence.
O'Donohue, who shepherded an exhaustive student investigation of the case, describes the innocence declaration as uncharted legal ground in Alaska, noting there is federal precedence. He expects the scheduled month-long hearing to bring forward key players in the long-contested murder case.
The Innocence Project's case is founded most persuasively on the confession of an inmate, William Holmes. Holmes is going to testify in person the first opening week of this trial. He's expected to take the stand on Monday.
O'Donohue says others named by Holmes as involved in what Holmes depicts as a street attack may also take the stand in a case O'Donohue describes as stranger than fiction.
Who would believe that 18 years later, we would have a parade of witnesses essentially completely challenging convictions that resulted from one of the highest profile crimes Fairbanks has ever seen.
It's unclear whether any of the Fairbanks Four, three of whom are Alaska Native and the other American Indian, will be in the courtroom. Fairbanks Four advocate April Monroe Frick says the Native community and other supporters are raising money so that the men can attend the hearing in person.
The state has been ordered by the courts to bring George Freese, Eugene Bent, Marvin Roberts, and Kevin Pease here to Fairbanks. However, they have refused to transport them from the jail to the courtroom and have guards there. They said they're unwilling to pay the cost associated with that.
As of early Friday, an online fundraising site had garnered enough donations to cover the cost of having the Fairbanks Four in the courtroom for opening day. A rally in support of the Fairbanks Four is planned for Monday at noon at the downtown Rabinowitz Courthouse. The state attorney working the case did not respond to an interview request in time for the story. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission is fining North Slope Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower $35,000 for failing to file her annual disclosure report for 2014. In the investigation into her campaign for re-election last year, Brower and her staff refused to provide information repeatedly requested by APOC. According to Alaska Dispatch News, the fine is the largest the agency has ever levied against a candidate. Pat Forgy reported the story for the newspaper this week and joins me now. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Pat, explain what happened here.
Well, during the last campaign, 2014, Mayor Brower didn't file her end-of-year report, and the Alaska Public Offices Commission spent a long time trying to get her to do so, or at least file an accurate one. They have some information, but it doesn't have a lot of information on it. And they just finally got frustrated with being unable to get a complete report out of her and took it to the commission for a fine.
What did APOC staff do to try to get the records from the Brower campaign?
Well, they had multiple contacts with various people from the campaign who regularly promised to provide records but didn't do so. Eventually, they filed a subpoena and used a subpoena to try to get those records and were still frustrated in that attempt. And I believe the commission, when they looked at that, they called it a glaring lack of cooperation, some of the worst I'd ever seen.
Did her campaign give any indication that they were willing to work with APOC?
Actually, they repeatedly said that they were willing to work with APOC. They just didn't apparently do so.
What did APOC investigators find in the information that the campaign did provide?
Well, at one point, you know, months late, they provided the bank records of the campaign. And in those records, APOC found about $5,000 that hadn't been ever disclosed. And they also found $14,000 that may have been duplicate reporting, or maybe even a campaign activity that was handled outside the main bank account. They're not really sure what happened with that.
Was there any opinion within the APOC decision that said that it seemed like a lack of understanding of the campaign process, or is there anything to be determined as to why this broke down so egregiously?
Well, you know, making mistakes in campaign filings isn't new. APOC deals with that all the time. They frequently give first-time candidates the benefit of the doubt there. But in this case, Mayor Brower was running for re-election, and her husband, Eugene Brower, is also a former North Slope Borough mayor. So I think they figured that they should have known how to work the campaign filing process.
Pat, give us some context into how big a deal this is for Alaska leadership. How important is the North Slope Borough Mayor position?
Well, the North Slope Borough Mayor is probably one of Alaska's highest paid mayors, probably is the highest paid mayor. I think last I saw it was $220,000 a year salary, something like that. But the other thing is the North Slope Borough is awfully wealthy from oil taxes. There's a lot of spending that government does that the mayor gets to play a big role in.
When you reached out to Mayor Brower on the issue, what response did you get?
Well, I never heard back from her. I left a phone message and an email to her government and home email accounts, and couldn't get her mayoral scheduler in the North Slope Borough to even take a message for her.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Pat.
Happy to help.
Pat Forgy is an Alaska Dispatch News reporter based in Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, herding cattle on a remote Aleutian Island to bring them to market.
Helicopters started working from Nikolski towards Fort Glenn, pushing the cattle every moment they can that the weather would allow.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz introduced his budget for the year ahead to the Assembly today. It's about $2 million less than last year's budget, but as KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, that's after the administration scrambled to close a much larger deficit.
Bear with me for a second, because it is not always easy to talk about municipal budgeting without making everyone's eyes glaze over. But here are the two big takeaways. First, the administration is dealing with about $11 million less in revenues, and they've picked some interesting ways to make up that difference. And number two, this is just the first move in a much longer chess game over the budget. Berkowitz actually compared today's presentation to hors d'oeuvres ahead of dinner. The administration won't have specifics on reductions within departments until it formally presents its budget mid-month, but Berkowitz says he and his staff found places to trim during 3 months of review.
A lot of this was just wringing nickels and dimes out of particular departments and finding more efficient ways of getting things done.
The administration is trying to grow the size of the police force and fire department by about 30 positions. No easy task when you're dealing with a $5 million loss in state funds and another $7 million hit from the end of a dividend paid out by local utility MLNP. I'll spare you the details on that for now. The question, though, is where to get the money for more cops and firefighters without growing the budget? Part of the answer: oil money from the pipeline that's been locked up in litigation.
There was a settlement based on the failure to pay property tax over a certain year, or the right amount of property tax. That's an ongoing revenue stream in my estimation. It'd be like you not paying your house taxes for a couple years. It's operating money. Just because you haven't paid it over a period of time, there's a backlog.
So the city's taking $4.5 million from an account where litigated TAPS money has been socked away. Using that for the operating budget, though, is a concern for fiscally conservative assembly members like Jennifer Johnston, who's been through 8 budget cycles before this one.
This is a one time only, then maybe, you know, it's a band-aid that we could live with. But you can't use it at precedent setting because it's gone as soon as you spend it.
The other notable measure Berkowitz is using to close the gap is halting the SAP software project. When the administration announced a pause on implementing SAP, they effectively removed 16 salaries from the year-to-year budget, many of which went to consultants, not municipal employees. They're also reducing 12 positions from different departments, some of which are currently vacant, but a few will mean layoffs. No word yet on where. As Johnston says, the devil is in the details, and those are still on the way.
It's a beginning, but no, there's not a lot you can get out of it.
The Assembly has until mid-November to digest the mayor's budget and come back with amendments of their own. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
Scientists have found another underwater volcano in southeast Alaska waters, and this one is active. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
About 2 years ago, geologists studying an ocean inlet near Ketchikan spotted something unusual. It was a submerged volcano, about 150 feet below the surface. It was dormant. The experts estimated it hadn't erupted for about 10,000 years. Now, scientists have discovered another underwater volcano near Dixon Entrance, just north of Alaska's maritime border with British Columbia.
Nothing like that had been mapped in the area before, so we knew then that we had discovered something new.
Gary Green is a marine geologist working with the Sitka Sound Science Center. He and a Canadian counterpart found the volcano September 23rd during a study of the Queen Charlotte Fairweather Fault System. That's been the epicenter of some recent earthquakes.
We had just completed some survey work, and we modified our line to go to another place to look. And as we were transiting, we came across this big plume and this big cone where the plume was coming out of.
The plume was made up of methane gas. It was being released by a volcanic vent about 3,000 feet below. The plume stretched up about two-thirds of the way to the ocean's surface. But Green says there was no fresh lava or anything else to worry about.
We worked over the vent, right over the vent, and we're still around to tell about it, so I think it's probably okay for mariners.
He says the discovery sheds light on the workings of the Queen Charlotte Fairweather Fault System, which is offshore British Columbia and southeast Alaska. The fault marks where a huge moving chunk of the Earth's crust, called the Pacific Plate, rubs up against the North American Plate, which includes the mainland.
It means that this fault acts as a conduit to deeper in the Earth, to places where either magma or fluids that are heated by magma or geothermally heated at depth can migrate up through the fault to the surface.
It's providing us some really important new information about earthquake hazards in our area.
Tori O'Connell is research director for the Sitka Sound Science Center.
It's also helping direct future research that will help define the significance of understanding the fluidity of that fault.
Lava and other volcanic fluids lubricate faults, lessening the chance of sudden movement, but that can increase pressure on other areas along the fault, forcing them to jerk forward, and that causes earthquakes. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
For the first time in 5 years, cattle are being rounded up by the hundreds in the Aleutian Islands. The Bering Pacific ranches on Umnak Island are rounding up their tundra-munching cattle to take them to market. KUCB's John Ryan reports.
Alaska agriculture officials say the Bering Pacific is the state's biggest cattle ranch. It's also the only one with cowboys herding by helicopter. Unalaska resident Julianne Tucker works for the ranch.
Helicopters started working from Nikolsky towards Fort Glenn, pushing the cattle every moment they can that the weather would allow.
Tucker says this time of year, the weather is pretty sketch for herding by helicopter, but herding has to wait till the calves are old enough to endure being separated from their mothers. Tucker says they've rounded up about 550 cattle so far, with another 1,400 to go. She estimates the total cattle population about 6,000. After the roundup, the bulls will get put on a landing craft and taken across Umnak Pass to Chernofsky Harbor on Unalaska Island. There, they'll be transferred to the livestock carrier Falconia. That's the big white ship that's been anchored across from the Unalaska Safeway. The Falconia is managed by a Danish company and flagged in Panama. Tucker says it's been hard to find an organic slaughterhouse for their free-range beef.
Some people can only process, you know, 5 to 10 or maybe up to 20 cattle a day. Well, we got 2,000.
The bulls will be taken to a certified organic slaughterhouse in British Columbia. Tucker says she doesn't know yet where the beef will be sold from there. Danny Constantine with the USDA's Farm Services Agency in Palmer says it's kind of a shame to see all that Alaskan food exported to the outside.
When I hear that some of the best cattle raised on great grassland in the Aleutians is being shipped back down to the lower 48, this makes me wonder, gee, we have to find a better way to get that great local healthy beef into the mouths of Alaskans.
Julianne Tucker with Bering Pacific says once the cattle go to the Canadian slaughterhouse, they become Canada's product. But she says the ranch is looking for ways to sell its product in Alaska in the future. She also says the Discovery Channel is interested in doing a show on the Bering Pacific Ranch. And on Alaska, I'm John Ryan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Kayla Daroche. This week on AK, goat milk. Buying fresh dairy produce in Southeast Alaska isn't easy. The rugged, mountainous landscape doesn't lend itself well to farming. A couple in Petersburg is trying to change the way people consume milk in town. For the past year, they've been selling raw milk processed by their own herd of dairy goats. But as Joe Sykes found out, producing and selling dairy products in Southeast Alaska comes with a unique set of challenges.
The first thing you notice about Victor Nelson's farm isn't the craggy peaks, towering cedars, and glistening glaciers that surround the place, but the motley herd of animals.
We got chickens. These are all our does, soon-to-be milkers and milkers, and then baby goats over here.
Nelson farms with his wife Tabitha on a few acres of land at Point Agassiz, across Frederick Sound from Petersburg. They're the only family here year-round, and their animals are nothing if not free-range. As we talk, a large spotted pig waddles up behind us.
Piggy! Piggy! Yeah, you know me. I'm the hand to feed you. Oh,
yeah. But for the Nelsons, the goats are where the money's at. Although Tabitha Nelson says they got into the goat game by accident.
We started with two goats and just for like raising quality stuff that doesn't have all that industrialized stuff in it. And people kept asking us, and so we decided to buy a few more the next year and a few more. And
now there are over 30. In a field in front of us, there are about 12 babies frolicking in the long grass. They're pretty damn cute. But Tabitha Nelson says the people of Petersburg also go mad for their mother's milk.
I don't even think we could ever meet the whole demand for Petersburg.
Petersburg now has a summer farmers market, and many in town want to buy local. But the Nelsons are limited when it comes to selling the milk.
I don't really like the system because sometimes I can't get a hold of people and I can't technically sell that milk because it belongs to them.
It belongs to their customers because the Nelson's milk is unpasteurized. In Alaska, you can only buy raw dairy products through what's called a herd share agreement. So consumers in Petersburg own a share in the goat that gives them their milk. However, that share does come with risk. Unpasteurized dairy products have been known to carry diseases like E. coli. In 2013, there was a Campylobacter outbreak linked to raw milk on the Kenai Peninsula. Events like this mean raw milk sales are heavily regulated. And Tabitha Nelson says they try to be as clear as possible with their customers.
When they sign the contract, they get a sheet of everything that we do.
Nelson says refrigerating the milk as soon as it leaves the goat helps kill any potentially harmful bacteria. And over in Petersburg, Gina Esposito, who owns a share of the Nelson's milk, isn't concerned about getting sick. She says for her, it just makes sense to buy local.
The more you learn about where food comes from, the more like paralyzed you feel on what you want to buy.
But it's not just about ethical purchasing.
It really makes nice frothy lattes as well.
It's those lattes the Nelsons hope will fund their homesteading lifestyle for many years to come. But with the regulations as they are, it can be frustrating when you live a 40-minute boat ride from town.
Sometimes we wait for people and they forget and we have to call them, and with the tides and everything, that just makes it harder for us, and living out here isn't the greatest situation for this kind of a business.
But they're here because they're in love with the lifestyle. Tabitha's lived on Point Agassiz since she was 5, and she says she wouldn't have it any other way.
We did go to public school for a year or two or three in the wintertime, and my teachers were like, I think you need to get her back out there. All she writes about in her stories and journals is Point Agassiz.
But so she can stay on Point Agassiz for good, sometimes she needs to leave. Today is selling day. When we go back inside, Victor starts packing up a crate of milk out of the fridge to take over to Petersburg.
I know that I saw a 26 go by, but I'll leave the 27.
Before we set off though, I really just want to know what raw goat's milk tastes like.
I don't know if you're used to fresh milk.
Cheers. Mmm. Delicious.
And with that, we're ready to go back over Frederick Sound to Petersburg, where Tabitha sets up shop on the South Harbour ramp.
So I got 4 for you today.
Great.
No, I didn't.
In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're talking with Shalan Schreifels, a civil engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers. She's currently on rotation in Japan. That job has given her a unique perspective on her home state.
What makes Alaskans unique is the ability to live in the extremes and to adapt to any situation that may be thrown at them, whether it's extreme darkness or extreme light. And Alaskans love being outdoors and partaking in nature's beauty. My boys are both going to Japanese school in Japan. They're 5 and 6 years old, and they're getting to experience a different culture and the experience of being the foreigner. They're learning to speak Japanese and reading and writing in Japanese and relating to a completely new culture. Well, one thing that I always share with my Japanese friends is the first thing they always ask me about, of course, is the Northern Lights and the aurora. And the next thing they ask me about is the cold and the dark and the winters and how we survive in Alaska. My perspective on what makes Alaska special to other people is based on my experience. Whenever I tell anybody in Japan that I'm from Alaska, they immediately react with exclamation, "Alaska! Aurora!" So, to me, knowing that they know about Alaska and that it's a special place really cements it for me, that it's also, you know, in my heart that it's a special place.
Shalan Schreifels is an Anchorage resident who's on assignment in Japan. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to share your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Joe Sykes, Lori Townsend, Dave Waldron, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and John Ryan in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.